So, it's Sunday the 17th of March, the third and final day of the presidential elections, and you know what? I think Putin's going to squeak through. No, okay, that's fairly obvious. Instead, what I want to do today is look at what I'm going to be looking at when we get the full results of the vote. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. So voting is taking place still, and yes, of course, we all know the ultimate outcome. But nonetheless, it doesn't mean that these elections are entirely irrelevant. They do provide us with a variety of data points from which we will be able to glean some things about the processes, often subterranean processes, that are taking place inside Russia. And although clearly this is not some kind of watershed moment and we're going to see a brand new Putinism, but nonetheless, for various reasons, it also is both a sign of changes taking place, but perhaps also a harbinger of others. So I thought this was actually a good moment to talk not about the results, that can be for a future podcast, but for what I'm going to be looking at as I try to understand what may or may not have happened in these elections. So let's start with the actual results. And the big question that we have is precisely what kind of a vote is the Kremlin planning on announcing? Because clearly, let's not kid ourselves, it is not that actually the vote will be in any way free or fair. But on the other hand, there is this need to at least provide some kind of justification for the actual outcome. Remember, the bigger the gap between the real vote and the figures that are announced, the more likely people are to just feel that it seems wrong, and therefore for the effect of the election, which is after all meant to be a legitimating ritual. This is not about the public choosing who will lead them. This is about the public demonstrating as a civic duty their willingness to subordinate themselves to their leadership. So it is about submission, not popular sovereignty. But the point is, for that to work, it has to at least feel broadly acceptable. People must feel, even if they're opposed to Putin, oh well, I do seem to be very much in the minority. So obviously, quite what results they're going to announce will remain to be seen. But the smart money seemed to have been that definitely Putin will want more than 70% at the absolute minimum, and maybe even more. Now, 70%, that's a landslide by any kind of margin. But it's worth taking a look at, historically, what kind of results have we seen? And I'm excluding the election in the year 2000 when he was interim president, because he was still very much an unknown figure. And more to the point, at that stage, he had not yet closed his grip properly on the machinery of power. So in 2004, he got 71.3%. In 2008, pretty much the same. Though that was actually not for him, but for Medvedev, but let's not kid ourselves. 2012, oh dear, well, it was a mere 63.6%. 2018, it went up to 76.7%. And this is what, in part, the problem. Do the Kremlin's political technologists believe that they have to actually exceed that, what was, record-breaking figure in order to demonstrate that the country is united behind Putin? In which case, they're wandering further and further into the realms of fantasy figures. Especially because, look, if we look at the most recent exit polls, a whole variety thereof, and all the caveats that apply to exit polls at the best of times have to be kind of redoubled when it's an authoritarian regime. But still, you would think that the natural distortion would be for Putin. People just think, oh, I better just tell this pollster that I'm for Putin because it's safer. But in any case, the results that they've been giving have been, for Putin, something like between 55 and 66%. Now, look, I don't think for a moment that Putin is going to end up announcing a result like that. If so, it would be deemed to be precisely quite a humiliation for him. But nonetheless, it gives us a sense of the kind of margin of absolute fraud that we can expect. Because there's all the pre-rigging, the making sure that you pick a selection of political pygmies to go on the slate. In an article I wrote in today's Sunday Times, I described them perhaps unfairly, but I think fairly accurately, as a serial groper, an aging communist, and a youthful opportunist. And there's all the promises that are made in Putin's State of the Union address when he basically declares his intent to shower money on families, on veterans, on official workers, you know, budgetniki, and on all sorts of other different constituencies. I mean, this is all the sort of thing which, you know, is meant to predispose people to vote for Putin. But the actual rigging of the vote, which obviously will be easier this year because a large proportion of the vote is electronic voting, which in these circumstances is rather more amenable to being generally rewritten by the Kremlin. But nonetheless, if as it were, the real level of support is at most around 60%, then it'll be interesting to see what they choose to add up. But what's also interesting is if Putin is going to get, indeed, a record-breaking, let's just for the sake of argument call it 80%. I think it's unlikely to be quite that high, but let's say they award him, or he awards himself, an 80% of the vote. What that is also going to mean is quite a serious squeeze for the other political parties involved, the Communists, the Liberal Democrats, and Davankov's New People Party, which means, I don't know really what it stands for. It stands for youth and technology. And, oh, and by the way, some people are saying, oh, well, at least Davankov is an anti-war candidate. Well, he's not really. If you actually look at his statements on the war in Ukraine, what he says is, you know, I'm all in favour of peace, negotiations, but then he also makes it clear it's on Russia's terms. Well, anyone can be in favour of peace if they get what they want. And to be perfectly honest, Davankov's language is, ironically enough, very, very similar to the language used by Defence Minister Shoigu and Putin himself. So let's scotch the idea that Davankov has come out against the war. He's come out in favour of Ukraine capitulating, which is somewhat different. But anyway, so you have three parties. Now, you might think, well, why does it really matter what figures they get? I mean, they're all fake opposition parties, these so-called systemic opposition, much more systemic than opposition. Well, the answer is in some ways precisely because of the issue of managing the credibility and indeed the egos of the other people who are willing to play their part as being these sort of fake opposition figures. Now, in this case, for example, the Communists, they're not represented by their leader, Zyuganov, but this time by Kharitonov. In some ways, I suspect, precisely to set things up to make it less of an embarrassment when they get a bad score. Now, generally speaking, well, no, always come to think of it, I'm saying generally speaking, always the Communists come second. And again, the vote, it's ranged from, let me have a look, 11.9% in 2018, which was when Pavel Grudinin was standing, which I think was in some ways maybe artificially brought down to punish Grudinin for actually thinking that as an opposition candidate he should be in actual opposition to the Kremlin. But anyway, so that was the low. But other than that, it was 13.8% back in 2004, and then 17.7% and 17.2% in 08 and 12. Now, again, so what we're talking about is a certain expectation. Now, if the Communists get another sort of 11.9%, that's going to be a bit embarrassing, but, you know, nonetheless bearable. But what if they get less? What if actually Davankov, for example, or the Liberal Democrats, but more likely Davankov, actually pips them to the number two slot? Again, if we go to those exit polls, they're showing for the Communists anything between 3 and 6%. For the ultra-nationalist Liberal Democrats, anything between 1 and 4%. And for Davankov, between 3 and 9%. And I think it's particularly because from the point of view of, you know, anyone who is vaguely oppositionist, if you want to register a protest vote against Putin, it's easier to think of it as going for Davankov is the way of kind of registering that, because he is, shall we say, the least offensive of all the candidates. Now, personally, I would vote communist, I think, not because I want to support Kharitonov or whatever, but because I think that's actually the most effective protest vote. But anyway, no one necessarily asks me. So in this context, if Davankov comes second and the communists come third, that's going to be a humiliation. It's going to be a humiliation for Kharitonov, for Zhuganov, and for the party. Now, does that matter? Well, again, this is where I think it becomes a potentially interesting indicator. I wouldn't be surprised if we are heading for a future in which even this hybrid authoritarianism with a pretense at democratic politics, which anyway has been getting very, very thin of late, is pretty much dispensed with. I'm not saying that they're going to close down the Duma or anything like that, but even to maintain the pretense that, that democratic politics matters, I suspect that we're actually going to see that squeezed out. So it may well be that, in fact, the political technologists don't really care if the communist nose are put out of joint, even though that further undermines Zhuganov's capacity to control the party, and it further will alienate those forces who we do know still exist, particularly at the local and regional levels of the Communist Party, who actually, gosh, believe in something, or at the very least believe in opposition to certain policies of Putin's. So, you know, it actually kind of unleashes them, but again, maybe it just won't really matter. As for the Liberal Democrats, well, I mean, the current Liberal Democrat leader, Leonid Slutsky, is sort of distinguished by being every bit as unpleasant as his predecessor, Zhirinovsky, but nowhere near as charismatic and as colourful. So in some ways, I don't think they really count. But nonetheless, you know, I think that in this respect, if we have an 80% vote for Putin, the question becomes, where do the political technologists decide to apportion the remaining 20%? And if they want to sort of reward Davankov with, say, I don't know, 8%, then they have that much less to play around with to reward the others. So in some ways, it becomes an interesting exercise of at what point do you actually alienate people who up to now have been willing to be the supine participants in this entirely sham process. Second thing about the results worth noting is precisely there are going to be all sorts of smart people who will be looking at the detailed results, everything from, you know, who voted when to what the various regional breakdowns will be of the votes and such like, primarily to spot fraud. And in this respect, they've proven in the past to be really quite good at actually identifying the degree to which we can see votes being transferred. You know, maybe it's because of unexplained last-minute apparent rushes and votes for in a particular direction. Or maybe it's strange cases in which the results seem very much kind of in round numbers rather than the kind of messy decimal points that reality tends to provide. So this is going to be quite interesting. And it's one of the reasons why, for example, I am actually quite dismayed that, by their own account at least, HUR, Ukrainian military intelligence, have been unleashing hackers to try and mess with the results. Again, not because I think there's anything necessarily wrong with that. These are fraudulent results. But the point is, it introduces new anomalies that actually makes it harder for these people to carry out their forensic analysis. But anyway, it'll be interesting to see what they can identify, you know, and we can, from that, we can actually get a sense of what the real results were, which I think will be interesting. And one of the specific detail points on the results that will tell us something is taking a look at the regional distribution. Obviously, it would be nicest to know the real results, but even the announced results will tell us something, because they will give us a sense of who are, from the Kremlin's point of view, the particular winners. Remember, mayors, governors, and other territorial leaders will have been given quotas of not just the proportion voting for Putin, but also, most importantly, the turnout. This is the problem. You need to have a high turnout to be able to claim that this is indeed a successful legitimating ritual. But on the other hand, the less meaningful the vote becomes, then the less likely people are to turn out, or that they are turning out generated by a desire to protest against Putin rather than support him. which is one of the reasons why you have everything from, you know, prize draws at the polling stations to cases of people being bussed in from local authorities and other places where the state is able to actually control the electorate. So turnout matters. And again, it's the local officials who are meant to arrange that. And those governors who seem particularly successful at managing high levels of turnout and high levels of success, it may be that this will be for them an advantage, and it might allow them to break out of local into federal level politics. But it can also sometimes be a sign of the Kremlin itself pointing to those officials whom it regards as being the up-and-coming favourites, the golden children that it wants to show to the outside world are indeed, you know, real winners at the game of Russian politics. So regional distribution will matter, not least because we see if there's going to be another one of these sort of messes up in the North Caucasus, in which some Chechen constituency claims a 120% turnout for Putin or something like that. Okay, so that's just some of the things I'll be looking at in the results. What about in terms of what can then happen? Well, the first thing to mention is that there is a fair amount of talk about a potential political reshuffle. It is part of the system whereby the cabinet resigns en masse when a president is elected, so that the new president has the chance to appoint the cabinet that he or conceivably she wants. Now, again, I'm not expecting this to be anything more largely than a ritual. I don't, for example, think that Prime Minister Mishustin is under any threat. I think he's demonstrated himself to be both competent as far as the Kremlin is concerned, but also not in any way a kind of political challenge, which I think basically sums Mishustin up. But on the other hand, there is scope for other changes which could tell us something about the direction in which Putin plans to take his government. And in particular, and this is something I'm going to dig into in a future podcast in more detail, this point about Putin beginning to look for a new elite, a new generation. I think it is clear, if not to him, though I imagine to him, but certainly people around him, that the current big beasts in the system, and generally speaking, the current political generation in waiting, the 50-somethings and the early 60-somethings that I often talk about as being, quite frankly, not really that Putinist. They are opportunists. They'll be Putinists as long as it's convenient. But essentially, they are pragmatic kleptocrats, and indeed pragmatic kleptocrats who are beginning to get impatient as Putin's regime becomes increasingly gerontocratic, and as, you know, aging figures monopolized the top figures within the system. In that case, what Putin may well do, and I think if, amongst other things, we can get a clue of this in his State of the Union when he talked about the elites are not really those people who, you know, stole from the people, but instead he pointed to, for example, veterans of the special military operation. But generally speaking, I think there is that sense that the next political generation down, so in other words, we're talking about the 30-somethings and the 40-somethings, need to be cultivated as a counterweight to the senior elite. The idea is that these are lean and hungry wannabes, eager to break in, whether it's in terms of business people who are hoping to get new opportunities. And after all, most of the assets that have been stolen in occupied territories of Ukraine or sequestered from or taken over from Western companies in and fleeing from Russia has not largely gone to the existing oligarchs and the like, but that new generation of minigarchs who precisely, you know, have perhaps therefore all the more reason to performatively be loyal to Putin. So we see that in business. We may well also be seeing that in politics. And if we look at the sort of the cabinet itself, I mean, there is talk about Kirienko, the first deputy head of the presidential administration, becoming a deputy prime minister. But I want to talk about him sort of specifically in a moment. Otherwise, well, we may well see, first of all, a culling of some of the older figures to allow for more youngsters, or at least relative youngsters, to rise up. And this is one of the reasons why I think it's interesting that some people have been talking up the chances of deputy prime minister and federal or presidential plenipotentiary to the Far East, Yuri Trutnev, possibly actually rising up further. Well, I mean, he's a 68-year-old. So I'm not entirely convinced that the future belongs to him. Instead, we're talking about people like Deputy Prime Minister Marat Husnulin, and indeed Agriculture Minister and son of the infamous one, Dmitry Patrushev, 57 and 46 years old, respectively, you know, who are in some ways very much, I think, sort of being held as part of the reserve in case, for example, they need a Mishustin replacement or whatever else. Might Patrushev move to a different position? I think it's possible, though, and here I am being monstrously cynical, I would note that the agricultural ministry portfolio could, some people might say, be considered to be quite a good earner if you're looking for extracurricular enhancements to your material well-being, let's say. What else? Well, I mean, there's talk, for example, that Boris Kovalchuk, the 46-year-old son of Yuri Kovalchuk, one of Putin's closest friends and therefore obscenely rich figures, who currently heads the Interrao Energy Company. Some people are saying he could perhaps move to head either Gazprom or Rosneft. Now, Rosneft will be interesting because that would mean displacing Igor Sechin, again, one of Putin's closest. It's one reason why I don't think that's likely. But instead, for example, he could either become a deputy prime minister with overall responsibility for the energy sector if the existing one guy in that position, Alexander Novak, rises up. But more likely, look, the current energy minister is Nikolai Shulginov, who is 72 years old. So I could see, for example, Shulginov being pensioned off, Kovalchuk coming in to his place. Frankly, it makes more sense anyway to come in as a minister rather than coming straight in as a deputy prime minister. So look, there's lots of these kind of details, and I could thoroughly wonk out and, you know, cite a whole bunch of different 40-something and early 50-something-year-olds who could make it into the cabinet. I don't think we're going to see any kind of mass reshuffle, but I do think we may well see some strategic appointments for the younger generation, not least because it is a signal to the rest of that cohort that says, if you are loyal, if you are useful, if you are effective, then who knows what might happen. The very top of the system is locked down by the septuagenarians, but there are still all kinds of great opportunities. But implicitly what that means is you're going to have to take on the generation above you. You're going to have to, in a way, house train them to demonstrate your value to Putin. So there's an interesting scope for a generational shift there. Few specific people I'd want to mention. First of all, Defence Minister Shoigu. Now, on one level, he would seem to be an obvious person to reshuffle, given how monstrously unpopular he is with his own troops, if nothing else. However, I'm not necessarily convinced he's going to go. Firstly, because Putin clearly does not like the idea of any kind of disruptive reshuffle within the security apparatus, especially at a time like this. Secondly, because I'm not really convinced that anyone is that keen at the moment to sip of the poisoned chalice that is the defence minister's job at a time of a pretty unpopular and pretty, I wouldn't say unsuccessful, but let's say certainly not successful war. I mean, at one point, for example, Alexei Dumin, the governor of Tula region and former presidential bodyguard, was being touted as a defence minister in waiting. And he had already been deputy defence minister, head of the special forces and such like. The interesting thing is that whereas once upon a time Dumin was, I wouldn't say campaigning for the job, but through his public statements and his public actions, I think indicating a willingness to be considered, shall we say. Now that seems to be much less the case. This is not a fun job to have, especially because in peacetime, the defence minister is the top dog. The chief of the general staff, the senior soldier, is basically there to be the minister's general henchman and enforcer.
In time of war, and look, technically this is a time of special military operation, not war, but you know, in practice, we have seen Russia shift to its wartime condition. And in time of war, actually, it's the chief of the general staff who in many ways is much more important, operating directly on the commands of the commander-in-chief, i.e. Putin. And the role of the defence minister is really there just to make sure that the chief of the general staff has everything that he needs for war, which again is not a fun and particularly a successful job. Given that any new defence minister would almost certainly want to bring in their own choice of the chief of the general staff, and although getting rid of Gerasimov, frankly, would be a great asset, I would have thought, to Russia's warfighting capabilities, does Putin have the stomach to lose not one but both of his senior military figures? I think it's unlikely. So I think Shoigu is still shackled to that position. The second choice, particular individual I want to look at, is Foreign Minister Lavrov. Now, he's 74 now, and he has been trying for years to be allowed to retire. And he hasn't been allowed to, again, in part because of Putin's general disinclination to see Chern, and also a sense that there wasn't within the senior ranks of the Foreign Ministry a suitable candidate to replace him. Now, that may still apply. And to be perfectly honest, foreign minister of today's Russia is also a job that I think is a pretty miserable one. But nonetheless, I have a little suspicion that Lavrov may be allowed to go this year. Yeah, sometimes dreams do come true. And I think that, although we don't know for certain, but there's a fairly good chance that he will be succeeded by Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybkov, who is a seasoned diplomat, but in particular, although his particular focus, his real focus has been both arms control and also negotiations with and relations with the United States, but he's also worked quite a lot on South America as well. And again, I think this is important because a new foreign minister has to be able to balance dealing with the main enemy, in other words, United States and Europe. Also, the cultivation of the world majority, what we might still call the global south, and relations with China. So no one can obviously tick all of those boxes, but Rybkov comes pretty close, and he has been, frankly, fairly high profile of late, which could well be a sign that he's being sort of finally given the final audition to replace Lavrov. We'll wait and see. Finally, on this particular issue, I mentioned Sergei Kiryenko, the first deputy head of the presidential administration, someone who was once so-called Kinder Surprise, was a sort of unexpected young radical reformist, but more of an economic liberal necessarily rather than a political liberal. But still, he had an exceedingly brief tenure as prime minister. And frankly, he has reinvented himself pretty comprehensively now, from being a sort of liberal figure to being one of the real architects of late Putinism. And in some ways, I would say that if we could think of the Surkov era, when you had the whole managed democracy, dramaturgia, sort of treating politics really as a theatrical experience more than anything else, Kiryenko is, I would say, the architect of the late Putinism, which I think increasingly is simply about mobilization. It is about building new channels for really the control of the public narrative to the degree in which people are not participative, but instead simply accepting the realities of power. And in this context, there is a constant talk about whether or not he's going to be shifted from the relative back room of the presidential administration, however phenomenally powerful a back room that is, into actual mainstream administration with a view to once again becoming prime minister. So there is talk of Kiryenko possibly becoming a deputy prime minister, or indeed conceivably a prime minister, full stop. Now, the interesting thing about Kiryenko is the way his portfolio has expanded. On one level, you know, essentially the core element of his job is domestic political management. There are others who are also involved, but that's really been core. However, he has very much used this as an opportunity to build something about creating this new elite. For example, he's a key figure behind the Leaders of Russia program, which identifies what are regarded as potential high flyers, clearly potentially loyal high flyers, and gives them training and encouragement and mentorship with an idea of accelerating their passage up through the ranks. But we've also seen there's been a fascinating expose of spending figures from his part of the presidential administration, which has demonstrated the degree to which they're involved in supporting films and other media events that have the right kind of ideological line. All kind of other ways of, you know, again, spotting the people who are essentially going to be the shapers of the next political generation. So teachers, mayors, you name it. This is a man who is engaged in very much an attempt to control what Stalin called the engineers of the human soul. In other words, those people who get to determine, I hesitate to call them influencers, because that makes them sound as if they're just simply basically advertising face creams on Instagram. But who are the people who are going to influence the attitudes, the views, the deep political culture of the future? And if all that wasn't enough, he's also in effect become viceroy over the occupied territories. He doesn't necessarily have kind of day-to-day political control over them, but nonetheless he does have them as part of his overall portfolio. So in this respect he has united immediate political management, which in this case has basically meant stage managing the presidential election, with deep influence over the future, the long-term political culture of Russia, with building specifically a new network of elites which gives him massive patronage powers, and finally also in effect territorial control over areas that really matter to the Kremlin, these occupied territories. And again, if we're talking about patronage, it means that through both his ability to support cultural and political activities and also the practical control over the resource streams heading into the occupied territories, rebuilding places like Mariupol and the like, he also has the opportunity to not just skim but put contracts and so forth in the way of his political allies. You know, I'm not entirely sure, it has to be said, if Putin himself is quite aware of just how powerful a position he has given Kirienko, or he has allowed Kirienko to build. Now again, I don't want to overplay this. It's not as if Kirienko can turn against Putin. And I don't even think Kirienko is necessarily going to imminently become a prime minister. But if we do see him move out of the presidential administration and into mainstream politics, then watch out. Because this is a very ambitious figure, a pretty effective operator, but more to the point, has a surprisingly broad network of clients. Okay, so this has been sort of more nuts and bolts. Let's take a quick break, and then I'm going to talk rather more briefly about the potential implications of this election for wider government policy. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. Now, before I move on to policy issues, just as a quick personal note, last week I had a series of public events in Copenhagen, including speaking at the frankly really excellent History Days historical sort of festival, really. I must admit, I do wish that the UK had something equivalent. But anyway, a number of people came up and actually said nice things about the podcast and so forth. And I just wanted to basically say thank you. To obviously to all of you who actually listen to it, but in particular those of you who spend a moment to say nice things to me. And my apologies if I often don't really know exactly what to say other than, well, thank you very much. Now, moving on to policy. In terms of the effects, given that I had promised in the end of the first half to say that this will be a rather sort of shorter section, there is a part of me that wants to just say, so what will the policy effects of these elections be? Not a lot, really. And then end the podcast there. But I think you deserve a little bit more than that, because there is, I think, a little bit more relevance. Not because, of course, this election changes things, but in the sense of this election is necessarily, I think, a psychological and political watershed. And simply because there has needed to be a campaign beforehand, which means promises, and there will be expectation for something to follow after the election. One of the things that's going to be interesting to see is how far Putin's State of the Federation address that I've talked about in a previous podcast was actually real, was about real policy. Remember, he laid out this incredibly ambitious 6-year plan out to 2030. In other words, to the end of this particular presidential term that he's going to be about to win, for a total renovation of the country, whether we're talking about infrastructure, whether we're talking about industrial policy and research and development, whether we're talking about policy towards the family and trying to turn around the sort of demographic decline of Russia, you know, all of these things were there. Now, the question is, therefore, was this just something he had to say because this was his stump speech and he was going to make promises that he had no real expectation or ability to carry through on? Heavens, just like a real Western politician. Or actually, did this really mean something? And can it mean something when Russia is at war, when 40% of the federal budget is being devoted to security and the like? So it'll be interesting to see. We've got pledges, for example, about new national projects, and we have very, very specific numbers being offered. Now, again, these numbers tended to be through the 6-year period, so I think often the whole we're going to see it sort of punted back. We weren't planning on doing it in this first year anyway. This is going to be year 3 or year 4 or whatever. So there's all sorts of scope to fudge a betrayal of these promises, because that's really what we'll be talking about. But I want to see how far actually we see this quote-unquote new government, this new old government, you know, does it hit the ground running, which suggests an awareness of the importance of the underlying sort of issues, or does it not? And my suspicion is the answer is it won't. And again, we will just simply be in very, very Soviet terms. Lots of promises, a grand multi-year plan, 6 years instead of 5 years this time round. Nothing really achieved except magnifying the disillusion, cynicism and probably apathy of the masses. So we'll wait and see about that. There is one very specific potential sort of policy area, which is military mobilization. Now, at present, it is clear that the Russians are still able to recruit a lot of people voluntarily, largely by offering, you know, what are considerable sums of money, especially if you're an impoverished person from an impoverished region. On the other hand, the figures that they announce are probably rather exaggerated. I haven't got proper ones, but people who look into this in much more detail tell me that clearly it's not as good a picture as they paint. There are some generals who are absolutely of the view that if 2024, the year in which Russia still has certain advantages, particularly in terms of the depth of magazines, shall we say, it's got the amount of artillery ammunition it can use, if that is really going to be sort of fully taken advantage of, given that 2025 may well be a very different situation, they will need another mobilization wave. Now, I'm not necessarily saying 300,000 like the first time, but nonetheless, the idea is, look, you know, we need more troops. We need more troops for summer if we are going to use this to make any particular gains. And the advantage is, from their point of view, is you make some territorial gains this year, and in a way that creates a new baseline. If you can then hold those against any kind of presumed 2025 Ukrainian counterattack, then you are beginning to basically define the realities on the ground. And it's easier to use that as the baseline for future negotiations. Who knows if that's going to work, but nonetheless, you know, there are clearly people who have that sense that you sort of edge that line onwards until the point where you can really push no further. But for that, mobilization. Now, clearly, up to the point of the election, Putin was not only not willing to talk about mobilization, he was actually went out of his way to say we do not envisage that even being a possibility, because he's aware of just how deeply unpopular and deeply disruptive this was. Well, it might well be that now he has the election over, Not because I think he regards himself as genuinely having some kind of popular mandate that he didn't have before, but just simply because he doesn't have to worry so much about annoying and alarming and alienating a large chunk of his electorate. It may be that, Putin will be more willing to see a mobilisation. And if this is to be meaningfully ready for summer, it will probably have to be sooner rather than later, because there has to be a certain degree of time spent in training and outfitting and raising units or slotting them into existing units and such like. So that's something definitely to be watching. I'm not at this point predicting it's going to happen, but it will be interesting if in coming weeks we see a slight shift in the language of around military personnel, the needs of the war, and the possibilities of a mobilisation. And then if we're talking mobilisation, I think the other particular policy area is precisely in terms of mobilising the country. Now, we already see this tension between, on the one hand, a defence industrial complex, which really is now cranking at full gain. And one of the reasons, in fact, why I am a little bit more, substantially more, on the sceptical side when people talk about how quickly Russia could re-equip, rearm and reconstitute its forces after the end of a Ukraine war, is I'm not convinced you can actually run these plants at this rate for so long before they start to break down, need not just raw materials, but spare parts that they may not be able to get now because of sanctions. And it's not that easy to just hurriedly retool with Chinese stuff or anything like that. Anyway, one way or the other, you have a defence sector which is now on full, frankly, militarised status. But the attempt still to tell ordinary Russians, life is the way it always was. Yeah, there's a special military operation going on over there, and there's some true heroes and patriots emerging from that. But don't worry, there's McDonald's may not be around, but you can get a burger that's just as good. And yes, you can't necessarily now buy a Western car, but look at all these Chinese cars that are now on the streets of Moscow, etc., etc. So at the moment, Putin is still trying to have his cake and eat it. He wants a militarized and mobilized economy, but he also wants a happy, peaceful, everything is calm, civilian sector. Now, to a degree, that is obviously about keeping the population, if not happy, at least comfortable or quiescent. He may well feel that he can get away with more now, or that he just simply has to come off the fence and actually militarize the whole country much more aggressively. Again, I think that it's very hard to tell in advance, but I do believe that getting the elections out of the way, not least because of the amount of time and effort that was monopolizing, means that there is the chance for a policy shift now. So again, watch this space. Next few weeks and month or so should give us an indication of whether we're actually going to see this constant attempt to try and maintain, shall we say, the two Russias, the Russia at war and the Russia where everything is still fine and there's nothing to see here, or whether we see the two coming into more of a harmony, and that harmony will, of course, be a Spartan harmony of a militarised system. And then that sort of also leads to one final point, which connects with the whole sort of new elite issue that I raised in the first half. Look, I'm a historian by profession as well as just simply enthusiasm. And look, history is clearly not any kind of clear analytic tool for predicting the future. What it does do is provide us with examples and metaphors that may well help us understand what's happening today and what might happen tomorrow. And the one thing that I particularly found interesting was going back to the so-called Pomestia system. Way back when the state of Muscovy is still constituting itself as the dominant one across the various sort of scattered principalities of the Rus, in the period of the sort of end of or sort of dying days and then following the period of Mongol domination. You had this process of the steady expansion of Muscovite control, and in particular, the seizure of lands to basically create a new military elite. And what happened is, under Ivan the Great, and then also under Ivan the Terrible, it was an attempt to basically supplement, but also replace, the existing boyar forces. So you take territory. I mean, for example, in Ivan the Terrible's case, he sort of, when he humbled and crushed Novgorod, he took huge portions of this northern mercantile city-state's territories and parceled them out to his supporters. And it's a very feudal system. You get land, and in return, when the Tsar needs it, you present yourself as a mounted cavalryman, perhaps with a retinue. But what that did was it created an incentive for continued territorial expansion. Because the point is, these were your guys. Up to that point, you depended very heavily on the landed hereditary aristocrats, the boyars, who essentially, when you summoned them, they were meant to gather their military forces. But the point is, they were their military forces that they were coming to help support you. You couldn't necessarily trust them. On the other hand, these, the beneficiaries of the Parmesia system, were actually subordinated to you, the Tsar. So it's also about shifting power balance. And so it's a reason for territorial expansion, because that gives you more land that you can parcel out, and therefore more service gentry that are within your domain and on whom you can rely. Now, we could look at the occupied territories of Ukraine in some ways in the same light. Not that necessarily people are being sort of given landed possessions there, but you know, if we look at all the various businesses that clearly have been taken up, if we look at the political opportunities, because after all, it's not only locals who are filling key positions within the local administrations, we also have a whole variety of outsiders who are coming in. And if you are going to sort of become, I don't know, a deputy mayor in some occupied city, you probably have been offered a pretty good deal. Maybe it's actually that it's a jump up the table of ranks of modern Russia, you know, rather greater than you could have expected otherwise. Maybe it's that you've been promised something really good after you've done your term in this particular sort of, you know, war-torn and recalcitrant region, or whatever else. So it is clear that the occupied territories are representing in their own way an opportunity for a sort of a modern-day non-territorial Parmestia system. But there's also a kind of internal cannibalization that's going on. I mentioned, obviously, about Western companies' assets being parceled out. But I think there is also scope for a rather wider redistribution of political power. And obviously, political power means economic opportunities. Now, why this links into to the elections is precisely because, you know, however trivial, however sham, nonetheless, elections just psychologically, automatically represent liminal moments, points of transition from one thing to something else. And I think this is a point where we are going to see, on the one hand, maybe Putin, but certainly the presidential administration, looking to ways of beginning to kind of reshape the country in a way that pivots away from this residual dependence on sham democratic institutions, and one that is a much more managerial and frankly much more Soviet one. And likewise, it's a point where you're going to have figures within this new elite seeing this window of opportunity, hearing the inducements that are being offered if they're willing to sign up, you know, about how well they can rise if they are able to provide Putin and the regime with the kind of cadres, the kind of personnel that are needed, will also be pushing for change, for reshuffles. I mean, it was interesting to go back to that point about Kovalchuk Jr. being mooted as a potential head of Gazprom or Rosneft. Now, even though I don't think it's going to happen, the thought of supplanting Alexei Miller at Gazprom or Igor Sechin at Rosneft is really unusual. These are both figures who are regarded as very much Putin loyalists. Sechin even, you know, more so than Miller. If even they are being thought of as being potentially at risk, one can see a degree in which these hungry youngish men will be thinking, "Wow, the sky's the limit. Things can happen." Now, okay, Kovalchuk Jr. is in a rather unusual position precisely because of who his dad is. But the point is, it says something about a mood in the country, in my opinion, which says change of some kind is on the way. Now, ironically, it is change to keep certain essentials. It is, to use one of the mottos that were raised in support of the 1832 Great Reform Act in Britain, which is a major electoral reform moment. Well, the conservative figures who were supporting it said, reform that you may preserve. And in many ways, that has always been the watchword of the smarter, more cynical, but also usually more effective conservative that realises that you can't necessarily hold the line completely. There are times, there are crucial inflection points when you do need to actually bring about some kind of change. And in this case, it's not reforming and liberalising change. It's not repeating, as Putin would regard it, the terrible, catastrophic mistake of Gorbachev's. No, it's change in the sense of looking for a renewal of the elites. Now, ironically, this is something that Stalin was very, very good at. Putin, I think it's fair to say, will be sending thousands of current elites to be shot in the back of the head and tens of thousands more of them to end up in slave labour gulag camps. It's going to be a rather different process, thank God. But instead, it absolutely is this sense of, I think, Putin having shifted from a belief that he might well be able to stand down at some point, which I still think, right up until his invasion of Ukraine, he continued to toy with or fantasize about the idea, to now a recognition that he's stuck, and therefore he needs to have a system which is going to endure for at least 6 and quite possibly 12 and God knows how long years. And part of that will absolutely be changing, renovating the structures of power, the elites and the mechanisms used to control and elevate them in such a way as not to leave him in hock to the current political generation in waiting, the one that's just beneath him, but also as little as possible constrained by the needs to pretend to be a democratic leader. So, okay, put all this lot together, and this is just my own take, but this is why, although on the one level, these elections are just simply a shabby sham that one should treat with contempt, but on the other hand, from an analytic and political perspective, they are by no means meaningless, and therefore there are going to be reasons why it's worth digging into precisely what happens in the vote itself, but also that we need to be keeping a weather eye open for a variety of potential changes that could take place in future weeks and months that will foreshadow much bigger, I would almost say tectonic changes, within late Putinism. So, not quite as ridiculous as all that. But what I would say, final point, what we, at the moment I'm saying this, it's pretty much noon on in Moscow time. The opposition had raised this idea of noon against Putin, that saying, look, obviously ideally vote for anyone but Putin, but the main thing is go and vote at midday on the Sunday, just simply as a way of demonstrating your opposition to this system, but in a way that is not a direct challenge to the state, does not break any laws, and therefore does not make you vulnerable. Now, certainly, just by judging by early information about what's happened, well, at embassies outside Russia, perhaps predictably, but even actually also, you know, across the rest of Russia, east of Russia, where midday has already come and gone, there certainly was a surge in attendance at polling stations around noon. Now, again, it's too early to really get much of a sense, and to be honest, Moscow and St. Petersburg will give us a particularly interesting sort of insight. But just as what was fascinating about Alexei Navalny's funeral was not just the thousands, tens of thousands who turned up on the day, but the thousands who continued to turn up to lay flowers and generally sort of show their respects in the days that followed. It is clear that this election also provides an opportunity for the opposition, for generally people who are feeling opposed to the regime, which is not quite the same as being an opposition figure, nonetheless, to come together in ways that allow them to realise that they are not alone. Because that is a crucial instrument of this kind of authoritarian regime, is to make anyone who is sceptical or hostile to feel isolated and alone, and thus impotent. So again, it's not going to be a dramatic change. But if the election allows people to come together and realise, gosh, there are more of us than I have properly realised, then that means that, frankly, the struggle for the future of Russia is not yet over. Thanks, as ever, for listening. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.